wrap-up point. Put to you this morning to discuss. All right, very straightforward, I hope. Firstly, have you ever thought of your story as a gift to give away? Have you ever thought of your story as a gift to give away? And who could you bless with it? Yeah. Take a moment and have a chat. You may need to move chairs a little bit. Hey, Sam. Right, I'm going to come back to order. I used this picture last week. We have an idea, especially when we're young, of what our life is going to be like. And in the end, things are not as we planned, not as we expect. There's a certain mass of spaghetti there, isn't there, in terms of what actually happens. But each of us, we have a unique story. We've all come from a different place. We've all experienced different things, some similar, some less similar. And for each of us as well, the gospel has come to us at some point, in some way, shape or form. And we have come to hear about Christ, and he has impacted upon our lives. He's made a difference to us. And talking about sharing our story then, we are expressing something of that, aren't we? Not just that moment when we came to faith, but also, I'd say, different moments in our lives. As things look like that, in which we've encountered Christ, or we've received his mercy, or we've known his presence, or something, that we have something to say. And that's very much what our passage is going to be about this morning. You know, I think as I was thinking over this topic, this news story came to mind, and this was, I think, last year, maybe the year before. There were times when beaches, I think this was in the States, actually. This is on the shores of Lake Michigan, which isn't even an ocean. This is a lake, so this is fresh water. But where the beach was red flagged, nobody was supposed to go into the water, because while it was sunny up there, the currents in the sea were incredibly strong. And people had gone into the water, and not surprisingly then, they had got in trouble. And before the lifeguards or whoever else, the coast guards, whatever they have in the States to get to them, people had formed a human chain to go out into those currents and to get hold of those people and bring them back to shore. And that's really lovely, isn't it? And so in a really similar, in a kind of summary way, what you could say was that the human connections provided a way for people to be saved. And you can see exactly where I'm going to go along with that, aren't you now? You know, that human connection makes a difference. God could have said, go into all the world and hand out tracts, but he didn't. He said, go into the world and make disciples. He said, preach the gospel. That's a personal thing. It requires a personal touch. It requires a human connection. There's nothing wrong with tracts, by the way, but you see the difference I'm making. I'm saying we've got an opportunity to say something personal and human. It's not just information. That there is something experiential, that we know Christ, that we know God's love, that we've experienced that and we are passing that on in our stories. And so therefore, again, as we come back to this basic principle that we've always been looking at, we're discovering again that we're the right people in the right place to help the non-Christians we know think about who Jesus is. We're the right people. It takes people. Yeah? Let's read from Mark chapter 10 in that case. I'm starting at verse 32. It's a long reading, and normally I wouldn't cover as many verses as this within a single sermon, but I guess I'm cheating a bit because I'm not going into the detail of all that is written here. So Mark writes for us, they were now on their way up to Jerusalem, and Jesus was walking ahead of them. The disciples were filled with awe, and the people following behind were overwhelmed with fear. Taking the 12 disciples aside, Jesus once more began to describe everything that was going to happen to him. Listen, he said, we're going up to Jerusalem where the Son of Man will be betrayed to the leading priests and teachers of religious law. They'll sentence him to die and hand him over to the Romans. They will mock him, spit on him, flog him with a whip and kill him. But after 3 days he will rise again. Then James and John, the sons of Zebedee, came over and spoke to him. Teacher, they said, we want you to do us a favour. What's your request? He asked. They replied, when you sit on your glorious throne, we want to sit in places of honour next to you, one on your right and the other on your left. And Jesus said to them, you don't know what you're asking. Are you able to drink from the bitter cup of suffering I'm about to drink? You able to be baptized with the baptism of suffering I must be baptized with? Oh yeah, they replied, we're able. Then Jesus told them, you'll indeed drink from my bitter cup and be baptized with my baptism of suffering, but I've no right to say who'll sit on my right or my left. God has prepared those places for the ones he's chosen. When the 10 other disciples heard what James and John had asked, they were indignant. So Jesus called them together and said, you know that the rulers in this world lord it over their people and officials flaunt their authority over those under them. But among you, it will be different. Whoever wants to be a leader among you must be your servant. And whoever wants to be first among you must be the slave of everyone else. For even the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve others and to give his life as a ransom for many. Then they reached Jericho, and as Jesus and his disciples left town, a large crowd followed him. A blind beggar named Bartimaeus, son of Timaeus, was sitting beside the road. When Bartimaeus heard that Jesus of Nazareth was nearby, he began to shout, Jesus, son of David, have mercy on me. Be quiet, many of the people yelled at him. But he only shouted louder, son of David, have mercy on me. When Jesus heard him, he stopped and said, tell him to come here. So they called the blind man. Cheer up, they said. Come on, he's calling you. Bartimaeus threw aside his coat, jumped up, came to Jesus. What do you want me to do for you? Jesus asked. My rabbi, the blind man says, I want to see. And Jesus said to him, go, for your faith has healed you. Instantly the man could see, and he followed Jesus down the road. In Mark chapter 10, we are on the road with Jesus. And verse 32 starts off with the phrase, they were now on the way, or on the road, up to Jerusalem. Verse 52, it ends with that blind man, no longer blind man, following Jesus down the road. We're on that road. And for us, it's part of the discipleship message that Mark wants to present to us, what it means for us to be a disciple of Jesus. For a while now, Jesus has been travelling from his home area in Galilee in the north down to Jerusalem in the south. And we're on that road. That is the road. It's the road that leads to Jerusalem. It's the road, as Jesus himself puts it, in verses 33 and 34, that leads to the cross. And for Mark then, this section, this bit that we've just read, this is an important moment. Let me explain why. A few weeks ago, do you remember we looked at these words? Jesus saying, who do people say that I am? And then asking the disciples, well, who do you say that I am? And Peter replying on the behalf of the disciples, you're the Messiah. In Matthew, you're the Son of the living God. And he's absolutely right. But then there's this kind of embarrassing moment when Jesus starts to tell him what it means for him to be the Messiah, that he's going to suffer and die, and Peter turns around and says, oh no, that's not what you're about. That's not what it means to be Messiah. And Jesus says, get behind me, Satan. You're trying to tempt me, effectively, from going to the cross and going through with the plan of God. That passage and this passage are linked. Let me explain why. Immediately before Jesus asks these questions, we come across another blind man. Now Jesus, we know, is a great miracle worker. Nobody comes to him and Jesus goes, oh, no, sorry, too hard for me, I can't make them better. Can't do that miracle. And a really odd thing happens with this other blind man. We don't know his name. But he comes, he asks Jesus to be healed. Jesus lays his hands on him. But it's almost like he doesn't get it right first time. So the blind man says, people look like trees that are walking around, when Jesus asks him what he can see. So Jesus then lays his hands on him again. And now, of course, he can see and see perfectly. So you got that bit with the blind man. Then you get these questions about who Jesus is. Then you get this bit about the cross for the first time and why Jesus has come. And you get the fact that Peter can't see that. It's like he can see it partially, but not totally. He sees Messiah. What he doesn't see is cross. So he's a bit like that other blind man at that point. He sees, but it's like trees walking around. And what he needs to do is to see fully. So Jesus predicts his death in that end of chapter 8. He does it again in chapter 9. He does it again here in chapter 10. And then we get, at the end of this story, another story about another blind man. And look what happens. He sees perfectly. What makes the difference? Effectively, that in-between bit we've been wrestling with who Jesus is and why has he come? Why is he going to die? And finally, that final verse before we meet Bartimaeus, verse 45, chapter 10. The Son of Man came not to be served but to serve others and give his life as a ransom for many. Now we can see, yeah? This is how Mark's gospel runs, isn't it brilliant? It's fantastic. He's so clever in how he puts this stuff together. Fantastic. So now we know what Mark is getting at, okay? This is the story of Mark's gospel. We see who Jesus is. We know why he's come. Mark is telling us. But in this passage that we read together, we get, again, two people who can't see it. They can't see it right. And those people are James and John. That's a picture of the House of Lords. There is the Queen's throne in the middle. There's a couple of other thrones on the right and the left side. That kind of thing is what I imagine when I read what James and John were saying. They imagine glory. Verse 32 says, they were going up to Jerusalem, Jesus was walking ahead of them, and the disciples were filled with awe, and the people following behind were overwhelmed with fear. It's as if the disciples, and these two in particular, are somehow starstruck. They're wonderstruck. We're on our way up to Jerusalem. Jesus is going to go and be king. It's all going to be amazing. And Jesus could be saying, have you just listened to a word I've said? I'm going up there to die horribly, and I'm going to be betrayed, which means one of you is going to do that, and I'm going to be flogged and killed and spat on and mocked. 3 days later I'll rise, but this is the way that we're going. This is where the road goes. The disciples then kind of awestruck, wonderstruck. Interestingly, that the people behind are the ones who are afraid. And it strikes me very interesting, actually, that Mark chooses to include that story about James and John. It's a story that occurs, as far as I remember, in all three of Mark and Matthew and Luke. But it makes James and John look bad, doesn't it? It doesn't make them look good. It makes them look as bad as Peter telling Jesus not to go to the cross. I think it has something to do with what Jesus had previously said about how the greatest now will be the least important then, and those who seem least important now will be the greatest then in the kingdom of heaven. You know, I think it's probably something to do with that they're full of that and they're thinking, oh, we've given up all this stuff to follow Jesus. That means we're going to be the greatest! And they want to be the greatest! That's what they want. And they don't get it at all. They think they're least important, but they're showing their self-importance. But Mark concludes this story, and I'm quite sure James and John have not got a problem with him sharing this story 30 years later, 20 years later, whenever it was that Mark actually pens his gospel. Because what it does is it gives opportunity for the gospel to be put clearly. It starts off with James and John saying, we want to be the greatest. And it ends up with Jesus saying, if you want to be the greatest, you've got to be the slave of everybody else. And by the way, I'm going to give my life as a ransom for many. I didn't come to be served. It's such a great contrast them in their attitude between them and Bartimaeus. Bartimaeus is there going, Son of David, have mercy on me. He considers himself nothing. In calling him Son of David, by the way, that's another Messiah name. He's saying, you're king. The throne belongs to you. But have mercy on me. And he's rewarded for that, isn't he? James and John are seeking privilege. They're coming before the throne, if you like, and seeking privilege. We want to be on the throne as well. Bartimaeus comes before the throne of Jesus and seeks mercy. He's kneeling at his feet, so to speak. The two stories are linked. They are linked by this phrase. What's your request, or what do you want me to do for you? Sometimes the way people translate things really annoys me, because the whole point of verse 36 is that it says exactly the same as that second one, verse 51. What do you want me to do for you? It reveals, if you like, the wrong attitude of James and John. It's just part of that. But what it also does is it gives an opportunity for them to, or for us to make a connection. See, telling your story, and here's where I'm coming back to now. Telling your story, sharing your Jesus, your story, sorry, is saying what Jesus has done for you. We've all come to Jesus and asked something. Sometimes, maybe like James and John, we asked for the wrong things. We get a bit slapped down, as it were. But when we come to Christ and we say, I'm sorry, please forgive me, Jesus says, what do you want me to do for you? And we're saying, please forgive me. When we come to him in prayer and we say, please do this, be there in this situation, change that, he's asking, what do you want me to do for you? And we're giving that answer. So telling your story is the story of what Jesus has done for you. Do you see what I mean? Mark provides these little snapshots all the way through his gospel. All these punchy little stories. It's very active, his gospel. It's always on the move. He, time and time again, he uses this word immediately. You know, that immediately this happened, immediately that happened. There is no time to rest in Mark. We've got to move on. We've got to keep going. It's all about moving. You just keep going. These little snapshots then just keep cropping in. And for us then, when we're sharing our story, it doesn't have to be the whole life story. I'm almost, but not yet, 40. Just got to rub that in. No, Helen's not here. Some of you are twice my age. And if you've been following Jesus for twice as long. So you've got twice as much to say. Somebody that you're talking to doesn't need to know everything that's happened in your life in those 40 years. For example. But being able to say one thing that happened that's relevant. That's brilliant, isn't it? Effectively, it's thinking, when have I been in the same situation as that person? What did I ask Jesus to do for me? What did he do? It's as simple as that. Peter chapter 3 verse 15 puts it like this. If someone asks about your hope as a believer, always be ready to explain it in a gentle and respectful way. For James and John, it was all about them and which side of the throne they were going to sit on in glory. These stories are not about us, they're about Jesus. He's the hero. We're the person that needs rescuing, yeah? And so when we tell our stories, it's not to boast in ourselves. Instead, we tell them in a gentle and respectful way, because what we want to do is say, what if you were doing what I did? What if you asked Jesus? One interesting thing that I did pick up through this, and again, I think it's helpful just in terms of telling stories, sharing our story. Maybe I should have called this session Sharing Our Stories. Is that there's two kind of different emphases perhaps when we tell one of our stories. For James and John, it was all about the cross. That's where Jesus took them to. He said, look, the Son of Man came not to be served, but to give his life as a ransom for many. And for us, we all have that testimony of, I was a sinner. Christ came into the world and died for me. I discovered that. I realized I needed to be forgiven. So I came before him. I asked for forgiveness. He's forgiven me and he's changed my life. And that's basically where he goes with James and John. He wants to point to what he's come to do, why he's died. So if you've got a testimony, or you want to share something about Jesus, the crucified one, who has forgiven you, brilliant. But for blind Bartimaeus, it's not about forgiveness. But what it is about the person of Jesus. It's about his lordship, his power at work in our lives. Why do we pray if we don't believe that Jesus is Lord? If we don't believe that he answers our prayers, we wouldn't pray, would we? So to be able to give that testimony as well is also good. There's nothing wrong with that. Two types of story then. It doesn't always have to be about how you became a Christian, although that's fantastic. But sometimes it's about what God did for you this week, last year. Because it's testimony to his power at work in your life. It's testimony to his love for you. Testimony to Jesus' authority. Really simple pattern for sharing your story or a story. Firstly, what's the background? What made you turn to Jesus? What did he do for you? I'm a bit short on time, so I'm going to rattle through the rest of this. But try and remember that. What's the background? What was going on? What was that moment, that crisis, if you like? That thing that just pushed you to actually pray or to ask or to, you know, or to seek forgiveness. And then once you had done that, what happened? How did that situation change? What happened in your life after you became a Christian? However, whichever story it is that you're telling. This morning then, point number one. They call the blind man. They tell him, cheer up, he's calling you. Stories that we tell are being told because Jesus is calling people to him. And they're part of that calling process. This morning as I share from God's word, God is calling you. Christ is calling you to follow him. If you've never asked him for forgiveness through the cross, a new life and a new start, then do that. Jesus praises the blind man, saying, go, for your faith has healed you. It can also be translated, go, for your faith has saved you. When we come to Jesus and we ask for forgiveness in faith, Jesus says, fantastic, be forgiven, go free. Your faith has saved you. If that's you today, that's what you need to do. Secondly, just a reminder, again, we're the right people in the right place to help the non-Christians we know think about who Jesus is. Part of what we do as Jesus' disciples then, or what Mark, as I said earlier, wants us to understand as Jesus' disciples is that we are following him down that same road. We are walking that road with Jesus. The blind man didn't run off and go somewhere else for tea. He followed Jesus down the road. He started on that road that led to the cross. And so for us, as disciples, we're following Jesus down that same road. What that means is that we have to tell that story of what Jesus has done in our life, even if it's costly. If people say, I don't want to hear that. Jesus' road led to the cross. As disciples, we go the same way. Whatever the cost might be, we want to see new stories told about what Jesus has done for people. Yeah? Amen. Oh, man. Should we pray together?